takeoff.
Sea tide, Altimeter Zero Eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire projector.
Viper 01, be advised, the restricted area 6002 is still active.
Sir, yeah, that's on.
Next, picture 610, 13,000, targets in the
battle. Viper 1 targeted.
Juice, thanks for joining me on the podcast again. Two episodes here, so kind of the juice, like, dive into the background, but you're unique because you're an ROTC commander, which I don't think I've had anyone on. There are a lot of people who listen to podcasts who might fit the demographic who are either looking to join the military, do the ROTC route. If you want to speak about the academy, you can. Yeah, it's up to you, but I don't know anything about it. Sounds terrible. Or someone who might be a mentor or a guide to someone who fits the demographic of the age bracket looking to join the military, which I think ROTC is not a bad way to go. But yeah, Juice, kind of, can you break, give me a little bit of perspective of what you do with a role, and then we'll jump a little bit more into ROTC.
Yeah, for sure. So I applied for this program multiple times, like we talked about, and it was kind of like a payback. Like I wanted to, you know, make an impact to where people who were coming in didn't have the same experience in ROTC that I had, where I was like kind of disgruntled by the time I got to the commissioning phase. Yeah. And so, you know, I applied for that, the board, it's the officer, instructor and recruiting candidate list or whatever that you apply for. And wanted to pay back that way. So I finally eventually get here. ROTC is largely unchanged from where you and I went through the program. You know, I think it goes in waves of how long the program is, right? Right now we're in this phase where 4 years is what we would like. 3 years is the minimum. There is no two-year program, and there's no one-year program, unless it's like a super specialized like lawyer or doctor type thing. There is some one-year commissioning programs there, but we require students for 3 years, and so they've, you know, developed curriculum for us to teach the students, and I would say that honestly, in the role that I'm in here at North Carolina A&T, 3 years is, we are sprinting to get them across the finish line with that 3 years. I don't think we could do it in less than 3 years right now.
With that 3 years, they chop off, I mean, obviously they're missing a year, which I imagine the freshman year, again, I don't remember a lot of the curriculum, but I mean, that's kind of some of the, I mean, there's a lot of, all of it's blocking and tackling.
Yeah, so the curriculum, I can talk to that. So the curriculum freshman year, that AS100 year, is a lot of building block approach, obviously, right? It's teaching them how to wear the uniform. It's teaching them how to salute, how to stand at attention, that kind of stuff. And then it does a lot of the history of the Air Force. So you don't even really get into like the leadership side until your sophomore year. If you're doing it by the book, we try and introduce some of that the freshman year to give them a, you know, like a leg up and start them thinking, you know, critically and ethically and morally, like the way that we want leaders to think. We start that early, but for the most part, the curriculum is real just specific to history and how to wear the uniform, that kind of stuff. And then the 200 year, you start to, it's their like field training prep year. And so it's starting to get into like how to lead small groups and how to do GLP, you know, group leadership projects, that kind of stuff. We could go off on a tangent on how effective group leadership projects are, but we do a lot of them in ROTC.
Yeah.
And then obviously between the typical student between sophomore and junior year will go to field training, which is, when you and I went through, actually, when you went through, how long was it?
It was 6 weeks, I think. Does that sound right? Okay. I might know. There was like a 4 week and a 6 week. And I think if you did, you know, if you did the freshman year and your sophomore year, you did the 4 week camp. If you missed your freshman year, you did the 6 week camp, I think.
Okay. Yeah. So right now there is no like makeup at field training for the students. And so we have to make that all up at the detachment level.
Gotcha.
And it is a 2 week encampment.
Oh. So that's good. We're passing off the unit just like in the fighter squadrons.
And so what we used to do over those 4 weeks was, you know, kind of an evaluation of where they're at and what they do. And we are now trying to do that in a 2 week period.
Okay.
I can't speak directly to it because I have not gone to field training since I've been here. I missed it last year and then I missed it this year again. So
dang.
Yeah. But I do have, you know, my captain, is down there right now and he's definitely feeding me info on like the worthiness of it. And he honestly came back and kind of is starting to change my mind a little bit. He is saying that there is some worthiness to it and he thinks that there's some goodness to having them down there for that 2 weeks. So
I'd be curious. I do want to talk about field training because I think when you and I went through is predominantly you marched around all day long. Mm-hmm. You ran, you did PT, and then you marched and you marched and you marched and you marched, which I have my opinions on marching around and its utility. I definitely did a lot of marching on active duty. Oh, wait, no, I didn't. But it's like, I'm doing about face. How do I do that? So backing all the way up, the programs, you know, 3 year, 4 year, when I went through, I do remember guys on a 2 year program, they were doing their masters. Some were in career fields or with a degree like in electrical engineering, which seems like it's always in demand in the Air Force. Other ones, not as much. It seemed like that time too, they're still trying to get more bodies in. You know, this is the 2002, 2003, 2004 timeframe. Everything is kind of surging and a lot of dollars are flowing. I guess there's not a demand to find people. Is that a true statement?
Yeah, so right now, we're in this really weird spot right now. We definitely drew down the amount of people we were allowing to get through during COVID, right? Because retention was at an all-time high in the Air Force. And so they're like, oh, we don't need as many people. And so they pull, you know, like standard Air Force, we either go idle or max AB.
Yeah, no in between.
I mean, we all know that they're actually trying to find the middle sweet spot there, but it's really hard to do when you've got a force this big and so many moving parts and pieces. They cut quite a bit the year before. My first year when we were doing the enrollment allocation process, we were submitting the sophomores' names up, and Air Force, you know, they draw a line and go, everyone below this line doesn't get to go to field training and doesn't get to go on in the program. Or you can give one more year of college in the GMC, the General Military Council. I think that's what it stands for.
Yeah, acronyms.
GMC.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
It's freshmen, sophomores, underclassmen, if you will. You can give one more year as a 500 year and try one more time to become a POC or to go through field training.
Yeah, jumping to the POC, typical flow would be freshman, sophomore year, and then you would go to field training. Your third year, you'd be in the POC, the Professional Officer Corps.
Professional Officer Corps.
Yeah, look at that. I found an acronym.
There we go. Those penguins are jumping back on.
There's not, the iceberg is not very big, so God knows what just fell off that's really critical, but it's gone now.
Wait, where are your kids?
What's happening right now? So that would be like the normal flow, but what is the selection rate what is the typical selection rate? And I'm sure it depends, standard fighter pilot answer, going from getting into field training, because you have to get that field training to move on and stay and contract and yada, yada, yada.
Correct. Yeah. So like I said, 2 years ago when I first got here and did the enrollment allocation that first year, the selection rate was real low. Like I don't know exactly what the stats were, but it was right around like the 55%.
Oh, wow.
Low. We submitted 22 names and we got 10 back.
Dang.
And then there was some, drama that went along with it. Obviously, nationwide, I'm sure there was some politicking involved, but we magically found a couple more spots for people. And so we ended up getting, I think, two more after that. And so we ended up with 12 that we submitted 22 for. We got 12.
Now, was that the average? Like, did you guys...
I think we were really close to the average.
Okay,
yes.
Fair enough.
Yep. So then we fast forward 1 year, and we've got this messaging now that we're putting out that's like, hey, this program is, I mean, we had to do special counselings for our freshmen and sophomores to say, even if you're on scholarship, this program is not guaranteed. Like, it is all merit-based, and if you don't make the cut, you don't make the cut, and we will say thank you for volunteering and walk you out the door. And so I think with the combination of how big of a cut there was the year before And then the way that we messaged it, you know, leading up to this enrollment allocation, because I don't think we selected that many more, but our selection rate was 82%. So we submitted less, right? Like, and yeah. So I think there was just less people. I think COVID played into it. I think the desire to serve played into it. I think, you know, just the economy being crazy like it was played yeah. into it. We see that like the economy is high and the desire to serve kind of drops. And then as the economy drops, the desire to serve, you know, starts to surge right. again. So we're just in a really weird spot right now. We need people because I think people are going to start jumping ship again.
Yep. 100%.
Like the retention that we had, the false retention that we had from COVID.
Wait,
I think
false
it's
retention.
Go away.
What are you talking about? False retention.
Yeah. And then now we have a population of people that's less desiring to serve. And so it's just kind of the mix of, you know, kind of a nightmare for the Air Force. And so we're, I think what I'm hearing is that this is the first year in 75 years that we're not going to reach our recruiting goal.
That's big for the Air Force because, like, the Air Force, it seems like it never has a problem recruiting. We have a recruiting service basically to funnel people in and obviously play along, but it's not like the Marines and the Army where they're scrapping to find people. Yep. It's usually the other way around. You would think after all of this, like, and you're jumping, so the number, the percentage you're throwing out there, again, for those listening, if you're not catching on, that enrollment we're talking about is the summer between sophomore year and junior year going to field training, which is a requirement to go through field training, the air quoted, you know, boot camp for officers that allows you to contract. And that really starts, like, that solidifies the path forward and you have to do it. The fact that jumping from like 54% to 82% back and forth, that's a lot of elasticity. And I know you mentioned there are variables and people are trying to figure this out. COVID is probably one of the big ripples in that.
For sure.
You would think that at this point, the stability, that number would fluctuate, like, hey, because, I mean, even when you talk about officer promotions, like, and there have been some big fluctuations, but inherently, like, you know, like, I don't know, major is going to be like an 85 to 92%, and it's always that year after year, like, they have it kind of dialed in. So this is not something new, but the fact that it fluctuates so much. And it, again.
And again, this is just a snapshot, right? This is just my.
Right. Fair enough.
You know, 700 days that I've been here. But I just see a trend as and this summer I'm seeing the same thing. You know, like, I'm sitting back here not going to field training. And so I'm the one that's doing all the recruiting events in the area. And so I'm hitting all these, like, new student orientations for all the colleges that we have. And there just is, I mean, we talked to maybe three,
so
four each time and a lot of people come up and they're like, have you seen the new Top Gun? You know, like, that's what they want to talk about. And then they're like, well, thanks for your service. And then they walk away. That's
cool. Nailing it. Recruiting had a number, recruiting commander always has it, which I'm going to butcher it, but, you know, they said, like, in the 1970s, 50% of Americans had, like, an immediate family member that served. Mm-hmm. And then today, I mean, that number is, like, again, don't quote me on this, but it's somewhere like 13. It's a 13%. It's abysmal. So trying to reach those people, but out of, like, the 4 million youth that hit the age bracket that would be qualified to serve, yeah, you can go ahead and chop that in half with, you know, people who are qualified, who don't have a medical disability, yeah, yada, yada, yada. Like, it whittles down to like 90,000 people after you factor in, you know, grade point averages and then the propensity to serve. That's the pool you're digging for, and everyone is targeting that pool. It's kind of like the airlines right now. There's a pilot shortage, and, you know, there's only 5,000 people qualified for all the airlines. A lot of applications in, but a lot of people who don't meet the qualifications. Like, it's a small pool.
I talk a lot with, like, the leadership of the universities because they, you know, they're concerned with our attrition rate. And I keep telling them that our attrition rate is built in on purpose, right? Like, yeah. It is the way that the Air Force wants it, right? To get the most quality officers that they can get. And so we have, like, and this is not an official number, but it's got to be really close to about 85% attrition from start to finish.
Which, I feel as normal. Like I'm, if I remember like my class that started freshman year, let's call, I mean, call it 20 of that 20. I want to say it was like three or four of the original commissioned. The rest, like there are a couple got sprinkled in the, you know, second semester, third and fourth semester. And then it was kind of set from there and it whittled down to like 12 people graduating.
Yeah, we aim to try and get like 40 or 50 freshmen.
Yeah.
So we can get close to like a 10-ish graduating class at the end. But it's just tough. Like freshman year, we deal a lot with medical stuff. So they go through the Department of Defense Medical Evaluation Review, the DODMERB, which is a four-letter word. And they go through and, it, you know, like the military or the DOD sifts through their medical records and finds everything that happened to them as a child up to age 20. And, you know, they ask additional questions. And I tell everyone that walks in here, I say, hey, do not be surprised if you are disqualified the first time through this process, because we probably see like 50 to 60% of the cadets come back as disqualified immediately from DODMERB. And then we work through the request for more information or the additional medical information requests that they send us. And we probably get 50% of that 50%, so like another 25% through the process.
Gotcha.
But it's a good 25% right off the top that, you know, is gone from the medical process. And the crazy part is I can walk across the hallway, some of the people who get disqualified from us, and hand them to the Army, a warm handoff to the Army, and go, this person was going to be a good cadet, but we disqualified them. And there is some stuff for the Air Force that we need them to be qualified in medically that they don't in the Army. But I've seen probably in my 2 years here, I've seen four or five good cadets that would have made good officers in the Air Force commission with the Army.
It is funny. Again, all these parallel, like things just don't change. because the joke was you would see guys who started with you, they would get disqualified for whatever reason. And then we always did a joint run every semester with the Navy and the Army.
And then you'd see them they're
just wearing a different uniform. You know, they just go walk over to the Army.
So medical is another, or one of the big things that cuts people out of the program. And then for us, and I think some other institutions across the nation, the AFOQT, the Air Force Officer Qualification Test, is difficult to get past for some people. And so for those that don't know, it's a standardized test. It's like SAT style, 5.5 hours. It has not changed since we took it, you know, 25 years ago. Maybe some stuff has changed, but I opened the book and I was like, yep, I remember this from 25 years ago. Same pictures, same A10, you know, like trying to determine what, if it's coming at you or going away from you.
Yeah, it's terrible.
That kind of stuff. And then, so we work hard here, to try and get through that process. It's a pass fail on the verbal and the math portion. So the quantitative and the verbal is a pass fail. And then if you want to be a pilot, you have to score a certain number on that, pilot section, you know, but if you don't want to be a pilot, then those sections don't matter. It's just the verbal and just the quantitative that matter for you.
Gotcha. I know the other episode we recorded, you said that now it's, well, you used to be like, you got two attempts, you had to space it out by 6 months, but that also has changed now too.
That's changed. Yeah. So you can take it once, and then if you fail it, you can take it again in 90 days.
Okay.
And then after that, you have to go to your commander and try and pitch, you know, like, hey, I've read these books or I've done this study session and I've proven that I can, you know, improve because you see my improvement between the two. And our region commander has the hammer on whether they get to take that test a third time.
Interesting.
And typically right now what we're seeing is it's a blanket approval for people to take that a third time.
Yeah. Depending on what the economy does here, you alluded to, I mean, if the economy is not doing great, it might have a lot more people flowing in that way. If it just kind of keeps doing what it's doing, I think the Air Force is going to have a big retention problem, at least on the pilot side of the house. Mm-hmm. And I know you mentioned, yeah, I said, like, getting people who want to be pilots now is a struggle. Like, it just doesn't seem like there's an interest as much. And you alluded to the fact that, like, that 10-year commitment is a big, you know, a big dark shadow hanging over, you know, the minds of some people. It seems like there's going to be some more flux come in the way of, I mean, the DOD just in general of like trying to get qualified applicants. Because also too, like the things that the military needs, if we talk to the Air Force, like you're talking space and cyber, the people who typically do that stuff, and this is, again, a generalization, don't want to do PT tests, don't want to have to wear a uniform and, you know, cut their hair and stuff like that. And again, that's a generalization. Not everyone fits that bill, but I know that's one challenge. Or the fact that, hey, you can go work for Microsoft and make 5X or whatever it might be.
Correct, yeah. So the thing that I've seen that I've kind of been impressed with is how the Space Force is trying to be different. Yeah. They're trying to do some of that stuff differently. North Carolina A&T signed a partnership with the Space Force. It's like one of eight universities, one of eight or nine universities that signed with the Space Force. It's an educational partnership agreement, and they're kind of trying to, the Space Force is looking at the way they do their, you know, their PME throughout their career, where they can send them to these uniform, these different universities to get their masters and do the research there.
Yeah.
And kind of target what they're trying to teach their officer corps. So it's kind of a, it's a cool concept. And then you alluded to the PT test. I think they're trying to do some things different with the PT test, but it's really, really difficult because most of that PT test is driven by DOD,
right?
A DOD reg, right? So if you're in the DOD, which they are, you're kind of hands are tied and you have to do some of the things that we do. So that part is just tough for, I think, all the services to try and really be innovative and change the way they do fitness. I think you're going to run into roadblocks. Civil yeah. service. If you really want to be in the military but don't want to do the PT test, there's GS
right.
spots.
Yeah, I saw the space where they were talking about doing something like with the ring you can wear to like monitor your fitness. You know, I mean, I got a, you know, Garmin watch on my yep. wrist that's yeah. collecting a lot of data. just putting it out there. But it's all good. You know, you incorporate some of that technology that, man, maybe there's a different way of doing things. But again, there's always resistance. We talked about it in the, yeah. you know, your main episode there, the fact you're able to jerry-rig something and modify an aircraft for the entire theater.
You're still, you know, hamstrung by the government process.
Yeah.
And who's willing to take the risk, right? Like, that's the whole leadership puzzle that we talk about in ROTC is like, where does the risk fall and are they willing to take those risky, you know, moves? I don't know. So we'll see. It's the Space Force has been an interesting piece. Like, they're like, hey, you're now commissioning people into the Space Force. And I was like, okay, so are we teaching them anything different in the curriculum? And they're like, nope, just continue to teach the same curriculum.
Figure it out later. Yeah.
I think they're going to eventually, there is like a Delta down at Maxwell that is trying to do, you know, some of the Space Force stuff. Our DO in the Southeast region just swapped out and he's walking across the hallway to the Space Force
okay.
ROTC thing that they're starting down there.
Gotcha.
And so I think probably in the next 5 years, we'll start to see some of that seep in that we'll have like, you know, maybe a branch off at some point and they learn different curriculum or I don't know. It's still so infant. I don't know how it's going to work.
Yeah, it'll be interesting how it plays out. I want to back up real quick, talk a little bit like selection process. So we're talking about, again, going back to field training, that attrition rate or, you know, the acceptance rate of like 54% or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. I can't say the other number. Then what goes into selecting a student? Like what are they, what is it? I assume it's GPA, probably PT test.
Yep, GPA, PT test. They brought in this year for the first time, AFOQT plays a part.
Yeah, so that's probably hitting a lot.
So that like further exacerbates the problem. Like the ones that we are just getting across the finish line, they're then getting penalized when they try and go up for this EA board. But it is what it is, and it's what they decided to do. And so those three things, and then the commander's ranking is really the big rock that's going to get you there. And so that's, you know, we talked about subjective and objective. That's the piece that I can weigh in on and go, hey, this person doesn't do as well PT wise as this other person, but they are a way better leader than they are. And I can weigh in and kind of give them those extra points to get them across the finish line.
Gotcha.
There. And so, yeah, I mean, and then it just goes up. We submit their names. The ones that we feel can get across that finish line, we submit their names and they go up and they compete nationwide, you know, with all 145 detachments, and they just rack them from one to N and draw a number. This is how many we need. And below the cut line is where it falls. There is some different stuff with like tech majors versus non-tech majors. And there is some stuff there has been in the past rated, you know, people who said, hey, I'm rated and I'm rated qualified and I want to be rated. They may get a little bit of a lower threshold to get through the process. If they do end up with a rated EA, then they have to compete on the rated board that next year. And so there's some nuances there, but overall selection rate, you know, like I said, one year it was 55 and then the other year it was like 82 or something like that. Yeah. So we lie in there somewhere. The reality is we're probably right in like the 75%, you know, select rate of the people that should be nominated.
Yeah. Okay. And you said, I mean, the school is tracking that attrition rate, and I assume they're looking at kids who are dropping out of aerospace studies and say like, why, correct, why do you have 30% of your students enroll the first year and then drop out? Is that kind of like their flag?
Yeah, it does in the education piece, you know, like we go back to No Child Left Behind. Like there's some of that mentality of like, well, we can't have people fail. Right. And I'm like, well, they're not failing academically. They're failing in the other things that we need them to do.
Yes.
You know? And so, yeah, I mean, I think just through education, the school, at least A&T, North Carolina A&T, understands that attrition rate when it comes to the other things. If we were failing people out for academics, then they would get it. The AFLQT is a sticking point. They are wanting to help with that somehow, but you know, there's rules involved where we can't help the students so much. They have loosened up some a little bit, and so the students can now study in groups together, which you weren't allowed to study in groups before. And so that the Air Force is kind of looking at ways that they can maybe help some of the you know, the populations that struggle with that test, which is largely the population that we have in this detachment, from, you know, underserved populations, minority populations, English as a second language populations. They struggle big time with that test. And so yeah. The school definitely has tried to help give us, they give us like an SAT prep course. It's through Kaplan and it's free for our students. They sign up and it's online and they can take this test, you know, repeatedly just to learn how to take tests.
Okay.
To hopefully do better on that AFLQT team. And then we were talking about how you get through the process for EA. So those are the big things that they look at. And then it goes up and the Air Force cuts where they cut. And then we counsel and say, you know, typically if I put their name up for that process, for the EA process, and they don't get through it, and they have the ability to extend their college a year, I will offer them a 500 spot and see if they want to extend their college 1 year and retry the next year. But if they don't get themselves qualified medically or they can't pass the PT test, I typically don't, you know, I don't want to waste their time and I don't want to waste our time either.
If they get that 500 slot, do they repeat their sophomore year in ROTC, or is it like keep going in track and then the last year you're like hanging out?
I think it's a little bit different at each detachment. What we used to do before I got here was they went back and they basically joined the 200 crew that was incoming and reassimilated themselves into that team. We were getting 0% of our 500s through this process because they were basically like retrograding their leadership back to the 200 level and having to relearn everything. And so I've challenged our cadet wing commander and I say, hey, every time we have like the interviews for the cadet wing commander, I say, hey, these people are going to be your 500s next year. What are you going to do with them that's going to make them better? And so we've challenged our POC to kind of, you know, stretch those 500s. And, you know, we created a position this last semester for one that was an intel officer.
Okay.
And so this dude worked directly with one of the, like the OG maybe, the ops group commander, the cadet ops group commander, and a cadre member to develop intel briefs, you know, like the collateral level off Google style. But like he was really stretching his knowledge base to like learn about threat countries and that kind of stuff. And then he was up like presenting in front of the entire cadet wing the whole time, and he crushed it. I mean, his leadership, like, you saw it like skyrocket during his 500 year, and he got through. He's going to field training this summer. And so I think that's probably the better answer for those 500s is to, like, figure out something to do with them rather than just retrograde them back to 200 year.
Hey, I just need you to tread water for another year, basically. Yeah. Like, it's not really going to push anyone. Interesting. And I imagine, what are you guys seeing out of, what is a typical commissioning class size and where are they going career-wise?
So for ours, it's funny. We can get into a RAND study that's out right now, but for ours, we've seen, since I've been here, we've seen about 10 each year.
Okay.
A couple in the winter time frame will graduate, you know, like at their 4.5 year mark, they'll graduate. That counts for that fiscal year. And then we'll graduate probably, we graduated just 8 here in May. So that got us to 10.
Okay.
This semester. We had a couple seniors fall out. We would have had like 12 or 13, but is what it is. We got 10. And that's what our, you know, the DoD challenges each detachment to graduate 10, which would get us to our 1500-ish that we need.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of detachments don't get there, and we haven't in the past. I don't really pay attention to the numbers. It's one of those things where if I don't have quality people to put through, I'm not going to, you know, commission them. So, what do we see for career fields is kind of a smattering. Large engineering program here at North Carolina A&T. And so if you're a mechanical engineer or a electrical engineer, you're going to end up being an engineer.
Okay.
Either like a program manager or developmental engineer type stuff. And then we have a good bit of people going to like CE. Like we have architectural engineers out of this college that we just sent one to be a CE officer. We typically have one or two pilots
okay.
out of that group, so like 10%. I would like to see more, like 30 or 40%. And I think we're going to get there in the coming years. I may not see it come to fruition, but I think we'll probably see 3 or 4 pilots in the next year.
Well, it's such a small pool, like the swing between 20% and 40%. I mean, that's pretty, it seems fairly reasonable. I feel like that's, again, my commissioning class, I mean, maybe it was like 12, something similar. And I think we had like 3 guys who get pilot slots, some follow-ons.
And honestly, we're all over the place when it comes to careers. We sent one to missiles. We sent one to contracting. We sent one to force support. I mean, we're literally all over the place. Maintenance. Logistics. I mean, so it's kind of just a smattering.
It's interesting. One piece I'm surmising that you, since you said you really don't care about the numbers, that you don't play that game. I do remember we probably had a similar parallel with ROTC. I really enjoyed it for the first 3 years. And then we got a guy, the Commandant of Cadets, who I didn't have a lot of respect for. Maybe I was a little young, but also today I don't think I would want to hang out with him. Again, it was the filing cabinet of what not to do. Wonder where he is today. But the professor of aerospace studies, I remember I had a buddy who figured out he could commission into the reserves and he wanted to go fly C-17s. Which was like, what? I was like, what is that? Little did I know when I showed up to pilot training, here's a little secret that people go to the Guard and Reserve and they know what they're going to fly when they show up.
Yeah.
There's a little bit more to it, but the professor, he was vehemently opposed to it. And supposedly it was because it was going to ding the numbers that he was going to have.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. He's not going to get his active duty numbers. We don't, I mean, they send us a thing every year and it says like, hey, your detachment's not viable because we don't meet the minimums for and it's weird because we'll meet it for that year, but they look at a 5-year average. And so if you don't average over 5 years in one of the categories to be viable, then you're not considered viable. And you know, it can be used. I've looked at it as just a tool that I can use to kind of pitch with the leadership of the universities to be like, hey, we need your support a little bit more in this area, or we can use your support here. Look, the Air Force is looking at this and they're really looking at our program because we're not viable, that kind of stuff. And so, but my leadership up the chain on our ROTC has said repeatedly, like, do not chase those numbers.
Yeah, it's good to hear.
So I think it's a good tool, and I hope they keep doing it because the university cares about it.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine the university is getting money. However, I'm going to guess that the typical relationship with ROTC and academia, there's probably some oil and water and tend to fall in different spectrums. And again, that's a generalization, but I saw it a little bit at Georgia Tech, but Georgia Tech, very technical school, like North Carolina A&T. It was a little more right leaning, so it was a little bit less resistance. It's not like UCLA, like I heard some stories.
Yeah, I think it depends on which university, but I think largely academia is, not super educated on the military.
Yeah, that's.
And so that part was one of my big surprises when I got here, and I would talk to people on this campus. The ROTC, the club, no clue that we actually have a curriculum, and North Carolina A&T students get a minor from our program. And I'm not an idiot because I don't have a PhD, I don't have doctor in front of my name. And so it's just their ability to fathom that we serve and our career is military and we educate ourselves just like any other career field educates themselves. And we are relatively smart people, critical thinkers. We can, think through problems. I kept, through the COVID piece here, I kept going across to the Army PMS. She was in logistics, I think, in the Army, or I can't remember what she did. The one that's in there right now is the Army. But we were, knee deep in the COVID, just setting up tents and testing facilities and all that kind of stuff here on campus. And it was a struggle to watch. And I kept saying to her, I'm like, they know that we deal with crisis and all that kind of stuff all the time in the military. They could probably come down and be like, hey, how would you do this or what?
Nothing.
No questions asked, inquiries of hey, have you ever had experience with setting up a contingency operation somewhere? And we're like, yes, you don't want our opinion.
Yeah.
So that's part of the frustrating piece is that we have to continuously tell people I'm not an idiot. I actually am educated and I can, do things that you can do just because you've read a lot more books than me.
Right.
So that part has been a challenge and I think it's going to stay. I think whoever sits in the seat next is going to have that same challenge. And maybe it's a process to get this person out of the office and meet people and spread goodwill.
That's one of those things. Walking a mile in someone's shoes. You never really fully understand it, until you do it. But I can see that, and we bounce all the way back to the exposure that Americans have to someone who served in the military. Obviously, that number has just dropped drastically, and you probably could say that percentage was already low for maybe someone who has a propensity to go pursue a PhD and just do academia.
So I have a pretty good story. So we talked a little bit about me being a white male on a HBCU, but I showed up and it was pretty chaotic because no one was around. Everyone was working from home. I was trying to get my feet wet and meet people. And so everything was over Zoom. And there's if there's not already barriers for me, now we've got the Zoom barrier.
Yeah.
And so my direct boss here at the university, me and her from day one, there was just some friction, but over the course of about a year, we have really gotten to a good place. And she is she's one of the most educated on the military people on this campus. And she's going from her position, she's leaving me, which is kind of painful, but she's going to be the dean of the engineering department, which is a good thing for us. I think now she's super engaged and wanting to learn about the military, and now she's sitting in one of the most technical engineering departments in our area. But her story is awesome. She dedicated herself to learning about this program and about the Army program. The Army has a program where they can take professors from the universities and go push them out of airplanes and parachute and do the stuff that like the cadets are doing. And so she is going to Fort Benning, I believe.
Oh, geez.
To jump out of airplanes, which is like, she said to me, she's like, this is so far outside of my comfort zone. That's cool. Like, but I feel like I have to do it just because I've sat in the seat and I've, you know, dealt with the ROTC piece. And so that I would say is like one of, if I leave here tomorrow, that will be one of my biggest wins, is like gaining her trust and educating her on the process. And she actually seeing the benefit after she did. I don't believe that she saw the benefit before me and the PMS really dedicated time to educating her.
Was that just constant interaction and asking for meetings and kind of if there's an event going on, bringing her by type deal?
It was, yeah. We kept her, it was one of those, like, she was not a micromanager, but you know how you deal with micromanagers, you just feed them information. So like, that's what we kind of sat down, me and the Army sat down, and we're like, we just need to feed her information of things that we're struggling with and whatever. And then we set up a monthly meeting with me and the PMS and the, her, and we just, it was just like a staff, like a stand-up, basically, like the weekly stand-up that you see at a fighter wing, where, you know, people bring information to the boss and go, hey, here's the stuff that we're dealing with, and anything that they can help with, they kind of help with. And she was that person for us. So she got us money. She got us money to finish our flight simulator. So we got a VR flight simulator in the building now, and the cadets are using it on the regular. Like, they're setting up a curriculum to, like, learn what a Cessna does and how it turns and all that kind of the physics behind airplanes. And then she also got us the podcast equipment, and I forgot to send you a picture of our podcast equipment. It's pretty awesome looking.
That's legit.
We're yet to record in it, but I think that's coming in the next month or so.
Yeah, that's cool. I think, you know, you probably have some relations with your fighter squadron commander, and demo, the my parallel with that was demo. Like, that's a resource drain on a fighter wing. Like, I had three jets, a bunch of maintainers that were all chopped away from the op squadron and the maintenance squadron. And the way I felt like we got around that is, like, we involved the commanders, like, you know, as much as possible, throwing them information. Anytime I did a show, I mean, it was a whole litany of pictures and storytelling of, like, hey, you know, why this is important. And then constantly harassing them to get in the back seat. You had to include the ACC A3, you know, get the 2-star in the backseat, where they start getting that buy-in, and they see it, you know, they feel like they're a part of it. And then when something breaks, you at least have a little top cover, because it's a pain for everyone, right? Like, no one's happy right now, but hey, this jet's, you know, halfway across the country and we got to send a truck and a bunch of other maintainers to go fix it. Like, getting that buy-in from adversarial leadership is not the right term, right? But they're managing a lot of other things and have a lot of other priorities, and you just got to be the squeaky wheel so you get some grease.
Yeah, for sure. I, you know, as a squadron commander, we had a great group of fighter squadron commanders at Luke, and our dedication was to involve as many of the support side and maintenance commanders as we could, just so that we had, you know, like, we had a camaraderie with them too, so that if we did need something, they could step up and help us out. And, you know, I think my support background helped a little bit with that too, where, you know, the very first time we had like a whiskey with the mayor with all the squadron commanders together, I think Mother set it up in the 310th. We went down there and there was the services or the force support squadron commander in there with us. And, you know, like, I was able to say, hey, I used to be services.
Yeah.
That like gave us a link, and we actually connected and became pretty good friends after that. So, I mean, it's just, I think the little things, and you hit it on the head, like the demo piece, it was like your very first command, honestly, because you're out on your own, you're taking risk, you're doing the things that a commander does. And so that networking and that, you know, being the squeaky wheel and making sure that people are on your side, I think is a huge piece to making it work. And so it's no different here. The tough part with us is we have 10 universities that we have to have on our side.
Yeah.
And so I spent a bulk of my time, you know, trying to network here on the campus of A&T, because it is the host university. They do give us our budget, and we are here for a reason, right? Like, it is the largest HBCU in the nation, and that's why we're here, is to help diversify our officer corps and help get, you know, what needed to happen a long time ago happen in the future. But at the same time, we wouldn't survive with just North Carolina A&T students. And so we do pull from Elon University and High Point University and some other ones around here. And so I've had to step out a little bit. And, you know, I did a webcast with the president of Elon University, who used to be the chancellor of, or not the chancellor, she was the provost of the Citadel. And so she had that military connection there. And she's been just an awesome advocate for us out at Elon. It's just been an interesting, I mean, it's so different. It's so different to be part of like academia and like try and integrate as a person wearing a military uniform on campus has just really been cool.
It's basically like a fighter squadron, but just different.
Yeah, way different. I don't know if I would say that, but yes, it's definitely different.
We didn't talk about like the crosstown aspect, but you're referring to those 10 other schools. Like, I assume it's still called crosstowns, but
smaller
universities, which might not qualify for an ROTC unit, but they can, students can still register and drive across town for leadership lab.
Yeah,
and
it's crazy. One of our crosstowns is Wake Forest, which is a big name, right?
Yeah, that's interesting.
I can't get anyone. That's like been my one of my objectives with the crosstowns is like, let's get a student from Wake Forest.
How far away? How far of a drive is that?
It's like 45-minute drive.
Yeah.
But it's like 2 miles further than Winston-Salem State, and we get people from there.
Yeah, interesting.
So it's just, I think it's just, how do I break into that university and the campus and like get our name out there? I don't even think people know that they can be part of this program.
That's probably a big piece of it. Like, You know, you don't have it on campus, so you don't see cadets walk around in uniform occasion. No one, the fraternity brother doesn't have a fraternity brother who's in ROTC.
Yep.
So you just never, It goes back to our previous podcast. If you're not surrounded, by an environment of people doing X, Y, or Z, like most likely you're not going to end up doing X, Y, or Z. Yep. Like I'm not a doctor, nor could I have been, but I didn't grow up around a bunch of doctors. I would have just been the reject from the group, but. I didn't know
and then I don't know if you want to talk about rated board stuff. So like further on in the process, so for students that get through that enrollment allocation process, their junior year is a big year for them. They compete for rated spots during that year. And then at the end of that year, they submit their non-rated line jobs, basically their dream sheet of where they want to, what they want to do in the Air Force.
And rated is now going to be pilot, WISO.
Pilot, CISO, ABM, UAS.
Okay. Is there anything else in it? We had Intel in it at some point. Like,
no, Intel's not in it.
Yeah, so it was weird. Yeah,
Intel's one of the non-rated line. I think that's it.
So,
they compete for that. And, there is a desire, and I don't know if it's because I'm here talking about doing pilot stuff. There is a desire for people to serve. Some people are qualified, some are not. One of the things that I was really surprised by is how easy it is now to get through the LASIK process. And so if your eyes are not perfect, which everyone thinks you have to have perfect eyes to get in the Air Force and to be a pilot, since I've been here, I've seen two people go through the LASIK process and two people get qualified and two people get pilot spots out of it.
Well, they go do it on their own. I assume it's like a waiver.
They go do it on their own. They pay for it. Yep. And so one of them did it between the rated board and the supplemental rated board, which happens their senior year. They did the LASIK and they got qualified. And another guy, which I think is better timing, he went to field training, came home and got LASIK done right away. And then he had 90 days to get requalified in the eyes of DODMIRB. That's a soft requal. And then 6 months from the time that you get out of that surgery is when you're actually rated qualled. And then you compete on that rated board.
So if anyone's listening and wants to do this, I know there's like a lot of paperwork that goes into it and then documentation probably. So like it behooves you not to just go get it before talking to someone probably who is
correct.
Who's
done talk it. To your cadre. Everyone knows kind of the game to play and how to get your eyes where they need to be. And it just depends on how much money you want to spend. Right. So like there's PRK and that's one way to do it. And then there's LASIK and that's probably the quicker way to do it.
Yeah. My wife just got it beginning of May and 2 days later, like full up, just has to do eye drops to like help out every now and then. And then like a week later, no issues, and got a big discount. 'Cause my dad got a LASIK done 20 years ago in the same clinic. So
It's the family member discount.
Yeah, you're returning or you're a referral. She's like, okay. It was like, take it. I mean, that part was
really surprising for me that because you know when we were going through, there was no option to like fix your eyes. If you didn't have the eyesight, you were unqualified and you did not get to compete for it. Now I had the luck, I guess, to get a waiver once I got an active duty. So like, I wouldn't have been able to go out of ROTC anyway because my eyes are so bad. I never got LASIK, but I got an indefinite waiver for my eyes, and I just wear contacts.
Okay. Because I mean, I had buddies who did PRK and they went through the process, and that was kind of a challenge. But it's awesome that you can, because the technology exists, you can get someone who can see and turns out like their eyeballs aren't going to explode. So that's great.
So then the non-rated line job obviously is all the other things that we didn't talk about that aren't rated. And then we look at this huge document called the AFOCD, and it has all these requirements for each AFSC. And, you know, the Form 53 that they fill out should populate what they are qualified for based on their degree. But there is some work that we do to try and get people qualified. You know, like if we see a degree where someone has taken all the classes needed for a weather degree, but they're getting a chemistry degree, then we can kind of fight for them to be able to apply for that weather position. And that's kind of what we do, is we just look at each person's degree and go like, hey, what do you want to do? And then we go to the Air Force and go, how do we get to yes for this person to be able to try and compete for these jobs? And then they compete for them with everyone nationwide, and it comes out all at the same time. We're still waiting on them right now for our rising seniors.
So they find out like pretty early on their senior semester, their first semester of senior year, what they get?
Yeah, I think we're trying to get to a spot where the NRL comes out at the end of their junior year. Okay. But we just like, it's just with COVID and like the staff being really undermanned, I think is part of the problem. I just don't think they can churn through that as quickly as they would like. And so now we're in the middle of the summer and we're still waiting on NRL release and Space Force release. So people competed to go into the Space Force, and we're waiting on those numbers too.
I know we got to wrap up here soon, but I do. So if there are any salient points you want to throw across, but I'm curious, the rated board and the non-rated board, what goes into those as far as selecting the individual or how they get racked and stacked, against everyone in the nation?
So rated is kind of like the EA process. They look at, all the different things, your grade point average. They definitely look at degrees maybe for some of that. So some people have rated tech EAs, and so they are kind of put into a different category. But for the most part, it looks like, do good on your PT test, do well in school, and then get a good commander's ranking, and you'll be sitting pretty well for that rated board.
So do you know if, 'cause when I showed up at tech, I was going to do civil engineering, and then I was like, hey, what do I need to be a pilot? I was talking to a casual lieutenant who was doing a master's in international affairs. He's like, you just need a good GPA. I was like, well, I wasn't very good at calculus in high school. Probably not going to be good at calculus at Georgia Tech. So I switched.
Well, and then the other part that goes into it is the PIXM. So the pilot PIXM score.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
I
it's
think
a PIXM score.
There's like an acronym within the acronym
right.
for that one.
Yeah, fair enough.
It basically just says how it's like a score that's generated from the TBAS test, which is the
TBAS test.
Yep. Battery, aviation,
aptitude. Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Aptitude. Yes. I'm terrible with those. It's so funny because I just look at people who want to be rated and I'm like, hey, what does the TBAS stand for? And they're like, yep, this is what it stands for.
That, yeah. That's all. I don't need to know it.
So the TBAS test, which is a series of like, exercises in memorization and like kind of hand-eye coordination stuff is what I remember it. I have not seen it since I did it back 25 years ago.
Interesting. Okay.
I just remember like the rudder pedals were really rinky-dink and they kind of scooted all over the floor, and I didn't feel like it was a fair assessment of my hand-eye coordination. Yeah. And I still hear cadets talking about that today. Then your pilot score in the AFOQT, right? So that part goes into it. And then flight hours is the other part. And so we try and maximize as many people as we can, get them through as many flight hours as we can through some of that You Can Fly scholarship money that I talked about before. But all of that combines with commander's ranking, GPA, and PT scores to kind of give an OM, if you will, an order of merit.
Flying hours, when we were going through, I remember I had my private pilot's license, but the difference of points between having your private pilot's license and 10 hours was negligible, but having 0 hours and 10 was a big deal. So is it still the same?
So they just changed these rules again, and I am not super smart on them, but it used to go from like 0 to 200 hours.
Yeah.
And you could go all the way to 200 hours and continue to increase your PIXM score all the way up there.
Yeah.
Now they've maxed it at 60 because they did some study and said, you know, above 60 and between 60 and 200, like the likelihood that person does better in pilot training is, you know, minimal.
Right? Yeah, that's fair.
They say the most bang for your buck is that 1 or 0 hours to 40 hours. And so they now maximize the points increase between 0 and 40. And then they go up between 40 and 60, but not as much as they do between 0 and 40.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that seems.
And they're in five hour increments, I believe. So 0 to 5, 6 to 10, 11 to 15 are the increments.
Gotcha. Yeah. That seems to make sense. And then for the non-rated board, again, that's really essentially just, is this guy or gal qualified to do this job? And if there's 100 people that want to be weathermen, there's still a breakdown.
Yeah, they just rack and stack all within there. And I've seen really good results. Everyone's gotten something, you know, on their top 1 through 4-ish for the most part. I did have someone put missiles down, like to be a missileer as her 6th choice. And I was like, okay. I'm like, you understand that you're probably going to get this. And she's like, well, I'm going to put it down anyway. I'm like, okay. And she got it because they're so undermanned. And so if you put it anywhere, 1 through 6, they're going to select you for it. And so that's where she's at. And she's happy with it now. Yeah. She was just a little shocked that she got that. So
wearing a seatbelt in an underground silo. Do you know they wear seatbelts?
Well, she's the first one on active duty too. She graduated May and commissioned May and was on active duty in May.
Wow. Which because is that? Are they delaying? Like, I got delayed. I was supposed to get delayed 4 months from commissioning to start, and it was like the first year they did that. And then I got bumped up to like I waited to 31 May because the academy graduated on the 30th. But then subsequently, I had, you know, guys who were 2 years behind me that had a year off after commissioning.
Yeah, we're still in that pain train right now. So typically, it's between 6 and 12 months.
That's crazy
from commissioning. Yeah, and there's nothing we can do about it. It's crazy, you know, like. You can compete people to go be a gold bar recruiter, which will pull on them on active duty right away. And we got one of those this year. But for the other people, like I just am now sending in, I think in May, I sent one of the people I commissioned last May. She just came on active duty.
You know, the Marine's humble opinion, again, it doesn't matter. I was casual for 15 months down at Moody. So the Air Force is paying a salary. The squadron put me to good use. I learned a lot of stuff. It was good for me to go do. But, I mean, I feel like it is a foul to put these kids, you graduate, and then, oh, by the way, go find a job for 12 months. And, who's going to...
find someone who's going to employ you for 6 months.
Like, what, you know, what plan is that going to happen?
Yeah, it's pretty painful. But there's, honestly, when I got here, I was like, there's got to be something we can do. And everyone's like,
I mean, it's been that way since like 2009, probably. And, you know, the ship has left the port and turned that thing around.
Yeah, it's painful. It is what it is. I tell the ones that can afford it, I'm like, this is your chance. Go backpack Europe.
Yeah.
Like, do something with your life.
Yeah.
That you're never going to get a chance to do after you get on active duty and get married and have kids. Like, do it now.
Yeah, save your money to go through RC. I assume they get health care. Are the option to buy health care?
Option to have TRICARE.
Okay, so at least they get
while
that.
While they're in the IRR, while they're waiting to go on active duty. But they have to pay for it.
Classic.
Yeah.
I mean, it's worth it if you want to get there. But again, that's Air Force needs to do a better job with that. That's my opinion.
I don't know how to fix that problem. I think it's just a capacity to put people through training problem. I think the problem stems like all the way through. So I don't know I don't know how to fix it.
Yeah, if you're doing that, yeah, that's probably one F-22 flying hour, so.
Yeah.
Different pool of money. Well, Juice, I know you got to run here. I really appreciate the time. Is there anything else you'd like to just hit on real quick before we part ways?
No, man. Thank you again for letting me come back on. I got done with that first one. I was like, oh, there's so much about ROTC that I didn't get to say.
All right, Rias, like when we do this, I forget, we recorded just over an hour for the first one. I mean, yeah, you're trying to capture all this stuff in 1 hour, right? Hey, surmise your career of 20 years in 1 hour, and we'll hit the highlights. I mean, we're just scratching the surface here. So, I mean, again, you're not the first person that we've done this. And honestly, I know people, there's going to be, a specific group that want to hear it. But honestly, the things we've talked about today, it's kind of broad brush that even if you're not looking to go to ROTC or even have someone who's going to ROTC, there are things that tie and weave through what the Air Force currently is and how it's operating. That's interesting. So,
yeah,
I appreciate it.
All right, man. Take care.
Yeah. Have a good rest of the summer. Get some good vacation in and talk to you soon.
Will do.
See ya.
See you, buddy.